Good evening to all. I can't see you, and that's very different from a normal lecture because I feel like being on a stage like an actor. But then there are no other actors to look at, and I can't really make you out there in the dark. Anyway, I wonder whether you have seen in the press or on the internet an historical picture for a few days ago. There's a huge poster on the Acropolis that says, "Peoples of Europe, rise up." And it is signed with the sign of the hammer and sickle, and the initials of the Greek Communist Party. We haven't seen such things on the Acropolis for a long time now. And I think that this too shows that Europe is not that black hole of reaction that has been for 20 years now, and that social movements are starting to play an important role, especially in the south of Europe. And this perhaps gives us a very practical and everyday reason to think about our peculiar problems in the former East European regimes and what remained of them. I have a written text of a talk here, but listening to some of the people yesterday and today, I have to point out a few things. What worries me in the usual discourse about Soviet-style systems and about the heritage of what is called imprecisely state socialism is the following. We still seem to think about socialism in the terms of the opposition between the state and the market. We still think in terms of a distinction and an opposition between equality and liberty. Now, the opposition between the market and the state, the liberal opposition between equality and liberty, have absolutely and utterly nothing to do with the problem of communism. Nothing at all. The contradiction of the state and of the market is a characteristic problem of bourgeois societies. It is an aspect of the history of capitalism where there are cycles of welfare systems and the preponderance of interventionist governments in favor of redistribution and egalitarianism, relieved from this impossible task by other governments believing in free trade and in free markets and in dismantling social services. Today I heard a very interesting talk by Boris Budin looking back at state socialism as a utopia, as an egalitarian utopia. Well, I couldn't disagree more. Egalitarian utopias are bourgeois utopias. Egalitarian utopia was the utopia of the French Revolution. The equality has nothing to do with communism. Equality is an idea of bourgeois democracy where social, political, and cultural equality is conquered or preserved while preserving at the same time domination and preserving at the same time the distinction between capital and labor. Aspirations within capitalist society to have equality that have been once upon a time an aspiration of the bourgeois left, then inherited by social democracy, may be noble and may be better than neoconservative governments, and they are, but we should be clear about our own aspirations. The idea that a supreme authority would redistribute goods, services, habitats, and etc. is neither appealing nor feasible. And this egalitarian utopia is the ulterior view of Soviet-style societies, and that's even unfair to Soviet-style societies, of which I'm not in favor and I've never been. And they may have been Soviet-style societies, and I think they were state capitalist societies. But they were, in many important respects, more than that, or different from that. One-party systems and Soviet-style regimes were not led simply by a nameless redistributionist office, but a party with proletarian class origins, a tradition of militancy, a class bias, and a commitment to social mobility, and aiming at and realizing the obliteration of old elites, in changing a great deal in the social psychology of these countries. These countries, these regimes have been plebeian. They ended old systems of deference and respect and modesty, and they were not looking up any longer at aristocratic classes and the church and traditional family structures and so on. And real socialism, as it has been called, at least it has realized bourgeois revolution, which is still unfinished elsewhere. But in these regimes, the working class continued to be exploited, but ceased to be subaltern. And if real socialism was like that, we who reject it uncompromisingly should point out that communism is radically alien to all this, because communism is a revolution against labor. When Guy Debord, in 1964, wrote with a piece of chalk on the walls of Paris, "Ne jamais travailler," don't work ever, and which then was imitated by many people, and this sign appeared on many walls, and then in 68 appeared on all walls. He formulated succinctly the difference between communism and social democracy, between communism and bourgeois democratic revolutions. What now the moderate left and even the post-communist left is offering us is jobs for everybody. But communism says no jobs for anybody. And that's a huge difference. If indeed wage labor is not rejected, and if commodity production is not rejected, if we are still considering the proletarian revolution as a realization of the desires of the working class within the confines of bourgeois society, i.e. jobs for everybody, and higher wages, and a participation in work management, and so on and so forth, which was the Yugoslav utopia, self-management, which of course would have preserved general planning, would have preserved political power as distinct from the management of the economy, however proletarian it would have been, that, then we have not transcended capitalism at all. And so when the weakness of the contemporary left relegates us to old slogans and old techniques and old routines of 19th century social democracy, jobs for all, and a decent wage for all. Of course, it would be nice if it would be possible. And then we are really nothing more and nothing better than nostalgics. Then we want indeed to go back to a world of old industry, rust belt socialism that is neither desirable nor possible. Contemporary technology does not allow more than half of the working age population to participate in the creation of value. Most of the contemporary proletariat is either precarious or unemployed. And the task of the future is not to create jobs by development of rust belt industries for all these people, but it needs a rethinking of the relationship of the radical left to labor. The state reappears in the contemporary struggles as the possible source of egalitarian or redistributionist measures, of structural adjustments for more justice, of resistance against the domination of the financial markets. In other words, a potentially progressive force, if it could only be conquered by parties of the democratic left bent on alleviating unemployment, poverty, environmental degradation, racism, and exclusion. Now, these tired old slogans. We in Europe don't seem to be any further than social democracy was in 1914, except that there is no powerful workers' movement, so that even reformism appears as hopeless. The new people's democracies in Latin America are again trying to build socialism through nationalizations, top-down education drives, extended social benefit systems, and the supremacy of dominant cadre parties with a concomitant conformism and intolerance. Marxists of many stripes are pinning their hopes again on developments dependent on the conquest of the state to end poverty and to break the influence of global imperialism. What is more, the anti-capitalist movements inaugurated at Seattle in 1999 were, as long as they have been moderately successful, not averse to talk to institutions of the global parastate, such as the World Bank, in order to introduce regulations limiting the damages caused by the terminal madness of late capitalism. I said once in London at a conference that the anti-capitalism, anti-globalization movements were a very strange combination of revolutionary street theater and reformist policies. And that has to be break up, and it has. It has to break up, and it has. If we wish to settle this, that is it worth the trouble to still consider the state as an instrument of emancipation? We should consider again what the state is in capitalist society, while avoiding the old debates about suppression or taking over the state apparatus when making proletarian revolution. The fate of Red October has answered this question. Neither reply makes any sense. I want to address the problem of the state from the normative standpoint of communism, if that is possible at all. For this, I consider that, one, the normative content of communism can be established only negatively if we don't want to fall into the trap of liberal moralism and lose the explosive force residing in the anti-metaphysical historicism of Marx. Two, the state ought not to be regarded simply, as it is by some anarchists, an agency of oppression and hierarchy. Three, the state cannot be understood outside law. Law is as much a necessary adjunct to capitalism as the fiction of economy is. The rule of law pertains to the essence of contemporary capitalism. It is part of its impersonal and trans-class character after the end of the bourgeois era. What do I mean by this? I think that the bourgeois era is not coeval and is not consubstantial with capitalism. Capitalism has survived both the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. The classical bourgeoisie and the classical proletariat are dead, but capitalism is alive, which shows, if any illustration was needed, that you cannot reduce the essence of capitalism to the straight and direct class contradiction which was the essence of the great battles of the 19th and the 20th centuries. Just consider the following very simple reality. In all great metropolises of Europe in the 19th and the 20th centuries, the distance between the government quarters and the proletarian suburbs, banlieues, or whatever, what have been the distance? 2 miles? 3 miles? At worst, 5 miles, that is 8 kilometers? That can be traversed by a proletarian march of columns of strikers and workers. And the power of the bourgeois state could have been, and indeed was a few times, overturned by superiority in numbers. Where is the center of contemporary capitalism? Is it in the government buildings in Zagreb, the government buildings in London, in Washington, in Paris? I very much doubt it. It is in networks of financial markets overseen by other networks. The center of capitalism has retreated from the physical quarters of power to the nonetheless real but physically difficult to be attained centers of abstract power, which was always at the center of capitalism. And direct confrontation between the forces of capital and between the forces of non-capital are much more difficult to find, as indeed our Greek comrades will find out very soon. Even if they overturn the government in Athens, they have not defeated their enemies. And this was not always so. It is not only state monopoly capitalism, a phase already left behind, that is dominated by the legal state, the Rechtsstaat or état de droit, but the thoroughly privatized capitalism of today as well. This poses the problem of the character of economic political domination at the present conjuncture and in general. Fifth, why, we should ask, the domination of the legal state, of rule of law regimes, cannot result in stability and equilibrium, as the legal state imitate communism in burning up all traditional institutional arrangements. I'll come back to this. Sixth, why should we resist the idea of rule of law and of human rights and of justice, as they are fundamental for the maintenance of late capitalism, while post-fascist forces attacking exactly that, whereby they are forcing the left to rush to the defense of not any longer existent bourgeois democracy, failing to transcend the dilemmas of the past? And seventh, why the conundrum of power is a false start? It is terribly difficult to resist the temptation of defending democracy. In the absence of any perspective outside the system, the left is reduced to protecting its chance to protest, to raise its voice. If bourgeois democracy didn't exist, the left, however fiercely anti-capitalist, could not act at all. The radical left at the moment exists thanks to bourgeois democracy, thanks to its enemies. In defending itself, the left is forced to abandon its energy of resistance, of systemic opposition. It is reduced to ask for toleration, calling for liberal, in principle ideologically neutral protection in the name of pluralism and diversity. For it has left. It has ceased to be a threat. While Soviet and Chinese socialism, that is bureaucratic state capitalism, still existed, it, even the new left, was regarded a real force. While Markus Wolf's Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung, it's a beautiful name, you know, this was the name of the East German counter-espionage service, and of course the name at the same time means the High Office for Enlightenment, Because Aufklärung means Counterespionage and it means enlightenment. Hauptverwaltung Aufklärung. That should be the title of a book about enlightenment. It's wonderful. So, this stood, of the official Communist parties, stood behind the Rote Armee Fraktion, the RAF terrorist group. Then, in spite of all the betrayals of the official Communist parties, 1968 in France, 1969, 77 in Italy, etc., it had, even the New Left, it had the ghostly authority of armed might. Today, the Left is effectively absorbed into the mainstream by its advocacy of fairness, social justice, equality, ecological rationality, immigrant rights, progressive taxation, by its targeting of racism, gender inequality, unemployment, precarity, neoliberal policies, corruption and the rest. All this is perfectly reconcilable with a more honest social democracy, notwithstanding a reservatio mentalis or two concerning communism. What I'm urging is not simply an increased radicalism, that too, of course, but clarity about what we are. Our advocacy and our protest are almost invariably aimed at using the instrument of the state for improvements, quite understandably, as no one wants to wait for a world revolution to change situations which are morally intolerable. On the other hand, academic and artistic radicalism, or if you wish, academic and artistic extremism, would elicit resentment in haughtily ignoring the travails of hoi polloi, rejecting of the many, rejecting or disdaining everyday struggles caused by its awareness of the danger of being co-opted in the liberal mainstream. Needless to say, academic and art world radicals are also dependent on the state, and not only for their livelihood. Foundation, government and EU projects are enrolled in the cause and for the sake of emancipation, as capitalism, discounting the forlorn hopes of 1990s neoconservatives, is still fostering an adversary culture. Look at this meeting here. And pays the price in having to tolerate trouble occasioned by the continuing presence of an opposition of sorts. The cornered and diminished left, although witnessing an astonishing burst of intellectual vigor, is relegated to a political dependence on the state, sometimes amounting to obsession, but this time without the hope or intention to conquer it. Kautsky and Lenin, Otto Bauer and Trotsky, were preoccupied by these problems, this problematic, because they were convinced the workers' movement will take over soon, and the state was to be the tool of of proletarian activism, which, aided by philosophy and science, will have used it in order to effect the communist transformation. No such hope at present. The left today tries to be the bad conscience of social democracy, failing to raise wages, that is social democracy raising, failing to raise wages, failing to reduce working hours, and to reduce the price of social services and to save the rainforest. However modest the scale of aspirations, the contemporary left attempts to commit the same egregious errors as its illustrious predecessors. Without going into historical analysis, albeit this is necessary, and the chronicle of the workers' movement ought to be always present in our minds, one has to go right in the center of the problem and assert that the state cannot be a solution to the question posed by capitalism as it is itself capitalism. I have tried elsewhere to show that there were no classes before capitalism, only estates or castes. Similarly, there is no state before capitalism. The state is still imagined as government, as it was indeed in the times of the absolutist monarchy and earlier, when the crown and parliament was still a reality. Ancient government was a truly separate body, as law did not extend uniformly to all subjects of the realm. Privileges and exceptions had been accepted as a necessary or indeed beneficent part of law. Even the expression rights usually referred in the 18th century, to specific entitlements of corporations and other collegiate bodies. Sovereignty, too, was imagined as separate, as it was vested in the person of the sovereign. Fealty and allegiance are called upon only where there is no order without the willed commitment of the suzerain, of the subject. Lèse majesté can happen only where there is no universal dominion of law. Now, bourgeois society takes pride in its separations, and they are verily its ideological, more exactly, Weltanschaulich foundations. It is only the age of capital that has invented the divergence between economy and politics, between the state and civil society, between executive and legislative branches of government, between law and power, and between constitution and positive law. I do not wish to say that these differentiations are fraudulent or fictitious, but I do say that they constitute a problem as thorny as commodity fetishism, which is also real, since its reified essence can be uncovered and de-reified only by a reductive analysis. First, the state is different from mere government, as it is an aspect of society unified by law. Unitary law, wherein there is a symmetry of rights and obligations pertaining to all citizens, dubbed equality before the law, solidifies society in a way in which all acts of will are subordinated to a coercion distant from violence, a coercion that is intellectual in nature, since it is contained in texts. Obedience attaches itself to the word, detached from fleshly persons. As carnality, flesh, is absent, the word, the legal text, appears as primary, primordial, primal, and primeval. Allegiance is replaced by interpretation. Normgerecht behavior, that is, law-abidingness, is logically an inference, causally a consequence from a correct interpretation of law, where the quality of citizenship implies a full membership in an interpretative community where meaning is prescribed away from the normal hermeneutic processes governing usual, everyday social interactions. The state is the prescriptive functioning of a community of meaning based on an imposed interpretation, the obedience to which constitutes membership in a legal state. The source of this meaning is hidden. Sorry, this is a philosophical text. What can I do? Second, the state is grounded in and through an assumption of the common good. The state is not merely an agency for conducting and managing public affairs, but it is supposed to possess an intrinsic value whereby a number of desirable outcomes can be not only achieved or attained, but must be formulated to begin with. The core of this intrinsic value is uniform procedure. According to Aristotle, the equal treatment of unequals is the basis for homonoia. Homonoia originally means in Greek being of one mind, and hence it comes the expression equality. But originally it has meant being of one mind, and this is what has always meant, because that mind, of course, is the mind of the state, incorporated, embodied in texts. That means the reproduction of inequality through equality. The notion of just desert, but you get what you merit, okay, just desert, will allow a differential treatment of the diverse, the result of which is the same fair treatment for all according to their station in life, whence equality through inequality. The common good in bourgeois society is precisely this uniform procedure ensuring equal dignity, equal rights for the unequal. This uniform procedure is enforced by the courts of law, ultimate guarantors of conformity to the word, that is, to enacted and recognized legal texts. The courts of law do nothing else but fit deeds to words, in principle unable to change the latter, that is the text. These words need not be words of the state, as the courts can and do enforce any words pronounced by any private citizen if he or she would establish his or her private interest in the shape of a contract, entered into voluntarily, but in a normgerecht way, ensuring fairness, the equality of the unequal. The extratextual compulsions motivating people to enter such contractual obligations are no matter for the courts. They should, however, exclude carnality, bodies, such as private physical violence, which is the paradigmatic case of extralegal or illegal coercion. Third, the state is the supreme authority, the höchste Instanz, which decides, and this is a continuous, ongoing decision taken at every moment, what is to be public and what is to be private. This is the essential differentiation, the essential inner boundary of a modern state, the difference between the public and the private, and this is decided by the state. This distinction is parallel with the distinction between politics and the economy. What is public stops at the factory gates. What is the state itself and what is civil society is also decided by the state. To establish a private sphere is tantamount to allow a dimension of social life where, although control is not relinquished, the equality of the unequal does not obtain. Private relationships are contractual. You can check in and you may check out. Within the public sphere, you cannot and you might not. In the public sphere, obligations are supreme. You don't have to obey the law only because you think that obeying the law is correct and is moral. You are obligated whether you want or not. Contractual relationships are subordinated to the sovereign will of the subject and are guaranteed by the state. On the other hand, contractual relationships are not constitutional. Therefore, they don't have to respect the uniform basic principle of equality. Obligations assumed privately and contractually could, between certain limits, inaugurate relations of hierarchy and servitude between people, since freely entered into by choice, that would be forbidden if they were applied to citizens. Exploitation and the social division of labor, which define the difference between the ruling or possessing and the subordinate classes, are formed on the market under the glare of Öffentlichkeit. Both are synonymous with liberty. The compulsion to enter such contractual relationships that are by their very essence unequal, labor, education, marriage, sale and purchase, etc., is not considered political, its inner content is not formulated in and by law, therefore moral judgments thereon are regarded as irrelevant, so nul et non avenu. The state is neutral as to the content of contracts, with certain exceptions, but it is there to enforce them. The state is the statutory power behind contracts, so the state, obeying constitutional rules, obligating it to respect equality, legal equality, is enforcing radically unequal contractual obligations entered into in the so-called private sphere and civil society sphere, where the so-called liberty of the private citizen reigns supreme, which makes an absolute mockery of the universal principle of equality before the law. Because as a private person, you are allowed to be unequal. Judgment, the state is the statutory power within contracts, but this is empty from the legal and moral point of view. Non-compliance will be punished if you don't hold at a contract. You'll be punished, of course. But enactment is not judged. So the state will punish you if you don't obey a contract which you have signed. But the state won't judge the immorality and inequality of the contract, because that's in the private sphere, that is civil. There you are not a citoyen, there you are a bourgeois, everybody is, right? Judgment is possible, nevertheless, from an alleged social vantage point, which is expressis verbis, outside the remit, political, legal, and moral of the state. Permitted actions against contracts, such as strikes, characteristically called industrial action, are viewed as economic struggles stemming from needs, not legal principles. People in bourgeois democracies are supposed to participate in government, but the private sphere is not governed. Hierarchy is enforced, although it is not legal, it is legally indifferent. So it must be clear that the state is much, much more than government. The state does not recognize unfreedom outside itself, while it safeguards it through ensuring the freedom of markets and of Öffentlichkeit, both are features of civil society, entities it does not govern, but which it does control. Hierarchy is thus enforced as liberty. Hence, the state is not an organ of capitalism, it is capitalism. It is the complete system. Fourth, if the state is this, and I believe this, it is, here there's a mistake in the printed text, could be used, if the state is this, could it be used for communist transformation? The yes to this question is something that I shall call the socialist illusion. There are two versions of this. The first is, of course, of the social democrats, of the social democratic variant, to use a democratic state through redistribution and ever-growing popular participation in government to abolish capitalism. The second is the well-known Bolshevik variant, which tries to fuse the state and civil society, markets, contracts, Öffentlichkeit, and to make everything public. This is an elegant formula in its simplicity, and I shall not lose any time with showing that it did not succeed in abolishing capitalism, because it didn't. The point is that it could not. Not only it didn't, but it couldn't. It could not, as it has maintained the limit between politics and the economy, trying, unlike bourgeois states, to govern the latter. By preserving the autonomy of the economy, the independence of which is a defining historical novelty of capitalism, the independence of the economy is new, is a recent development. It has not existed before capitalism. It had to yield to its specific imperatives: accumulation, growth, division of labor, technological development, commodity production, wage labor, competitive prices, money, and so on, all features in Soviet-style societies. Soviet-style societies never stopped commodity production and wage labor, etc. So that these economic, read capitalist imperatives, inundated the socialist state instead of vice versa, and the needs of the economy left little of this state but the enforcing of unfreedom where freedom was vested in the instrument of coercion, the state. The blueprint, the algorithm, the plan, was the paradigm of leadership, the putative leading role of the working class through the medium of science, that ended in the annihilation of the one innovative political institution of so-called socialism, the proletarian party, about which I've read elsewhere. You have this, my theory of the proletarian party, in this book that you have published in Croatian on the occasion of this meeting. Communist energies have been rerouted into the edification of its opposite, the state market couplet, with the priorities changed. But no fusion, but abolition is the aim. All right. So what I mean put it in a more simplified way, to relieve you of the weight of this style, which is mine. I can't deny where I come from. But the state market couplet which is characteristic of modern 20th century capitalism, was decisive in the fate of Soviet-style societies as well. This is what we have to understand. I don't mean that these societies, West European capitalism and East European state capitalism, were identical or even very similar. The differences are very important. But the parallels are very instructive for us today. What was the great political struggle from after the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the 56th Hungarian Revolution? What was the great struggle in the whole of Eastern Europe and within the West European Communist Parties? It was between keeping the supremacy of the state by a politics of accumulation and austerity, or the markets being invoked, the market socialism being invoked in order to increase consumption and to relinquish the severity of an accumulation regime with its concomitant puritanism, poverty, and huge mobilization of the popular masses. So do understand this. When the communist leaderships from Ulaanbaatar to Rome started to invoke a relaxation of the oppressive state apparatuses, an introduction of a modicum of the markets, and so on, their aim was not to construct a market system, but to fabricate a parallel to the West European welfare state. Their aim was consumption. Their aim was to put an end to East European poverty, hunger, austerity. And there is a protocol of a meeting of the Politburo of the Hungarian Party of Working People, it was its official name until 56, where there's an interesting debate between Ernő Gerő, who was the number two in the Stalinist regime in Hungary. He was one of the great murderers in Barcelona during the Spanish Civil War, where he was under the name of Pedro, murdering anarchists, anarcho-syndicalists, and Trotskyites, and a great figure of the Comintern. And between Imre Nagy, who then became, of course, the leader of the revolutionary government in 56, later being executed in 58. And he was, of course, the quintessential reformer, and Ernő Gerő was the quintessential Stalinist. What did they debate about? There's a debate in 54. Ernő Gerő, the Stalinist, says to the Politburo and to Imre Nagy that you cannot diminish taxes and raise wages and increase consumption, because that will create huge deficits and will lead to indebtedness. Okay. Like a contemporary neoconservative, every single term that the Stalinist is invoking is, you know, a partisanship of the accumulation regime. We have to keep the balanced budget. We shouldn't spend for social systems. All the Thatcherite wisdom we are so familiar with, which is very interesting coming from a hardline Stalinist. And what does the reformer, dubbed by Western historiography the liberal communist, say? That the Keynesian mantra, that it doesn't matter, that ultimately, if you spur consumption, that will give a boost to the economy, it will develop, and you know, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. So you have in 54, barely a year after Stalin's death, still under the portraits of the four great classics then, of course, Marx, Engels, Lenin, Stalin. Yeah, okay, under those portraits, you have a perfect debate between Mrs. Thatcher and Neil Kinnock. You have a perfect debate between Valéry Giscard d'Estaing and Mitterrand. And these parallels are not at all accidental. This was the great debate in 20th century modern societies, be they Western, be they Eastern. It was the great modernization debate. And it was a debate predicated on the recognition, on the orthodox recognition by communists and conservatives, by Nazis and liberals alike, of the autonomy of the economy, which some sought to decrease and some sought to increase. But the dilemma was seen in the same terms by all of these people. There is only one thought tradition that contradicts this, and this is called Marxism, actually. And you shouldn't think for a single moment that the Soviet-style regime leaderships had the first notion about what a real Marxist orthodoxy would say about this. And a differentiation between state and civil society, economy and politics is the main instrument to keep the regime in place, because it establishes not one overarching aim and not one overarching subversion. It keeps the legal system based on Roman law, which is again based on the untouchability of property, be it socialist state property or be it private property. From the point of view of the propertyless proletarian, it is not such a great difference. And if indeed no labor can be in any existent legal system create entitlement from property, you can, if you are a good socialist proletarian, you can increase your wage. You can even, by popular capitalism, buy shares and so on. But labor itself, it's not giving you a title, in terms of legal philosophy, a title to property. Because, and it was not in the Soviet Union, it was not in the People's Republic of China, it was not in Great Britain or the United States or Japan or wherever, not any system or the Third Reich, okay? No legal system exists in which labor can be transformed into capital. That basic difference remains. It has never been transcended. Therefore, the traditional struggles in order to increase the importance of labor, although they have changed a great deal, we don't live in the same societies as our forebears lived in the 19th century. We are not humble servants of our superiors. The subaltern classes, unlike in feudal societies, don't have a culture, a folkloric culture, that is different from the culture, the high culture of the dominant classes. Popular education, participation in the political process, the draft in the army, etc., have created egalitarian capitalist societies in which high culture, access to science, and access, which is the most important technology, the most important intellectual technique in achieving power, is indeed accessible to, not to everybody, but to great masses of people, which would be unthinkable in any ancien regime. It would be unthinkable. We live indeed in plebeian egalitarian societies in which still domination and the absolute imminent boundary between capital and labor, between possessors of capital and non-possessors of capital, still exists. So bourgeois revolutions and their version in Eastern Europe, executed by the communist parties in Eastern Europe and in parts of Asia, and also in some third world regimes, have not abolished capitalism, but they have abolished the systems of deference, the system of humiliation, and the system of inequality. That bourgeois revolutions in themselves would have never been able to do, and they didn't, even in France. Who did, after all, give us universal franchise, one man, one vote? It was, of course, social democratic parties in the 19th and 20th centuries. Progressive taxation, redistributionist states, welfare states, paid holidays, etc., etc., were indeed achievements not of progressive capitalism, but by its enemy. But this enemy, social democracy and Bolshevism, while changing a lot of the social makeup of capitalist societies, and changing a lot in the social pyramid, changing social convention and usages and routines immensely, has created modern capitalism. Modern capitalism in which, in cultural sense, class rule is much milder than it used to be ever before. It is not class as a close group of people with their characteristic behavior, demeanor, style, and language. Well, there are some remnants of that in England and elsewhere, where the upper classes speak with a different accent and so on and so forth. But that's an exception. But even there are changes in this. That, of course, has been conquered. We are not routinely humiliated. And which is an absolute novelty in the history of humankind. And that is indeed an achievement of capitalism by its being able to use its mortal enemy to its own modernization and to its own transformation into something else, in which crude, old-fashioned, caste-like class rule ceased to play a very important role. Inequality remains, but in very important respects that mattered immensely to people in the 20th century, where the generation of your grandparents, your great grandparents, and my grandparents, perhaps, they, if they were peasants, as most people in Eastern Europe were peasants, 70-80% of the population were peasants, in some countries, not everywhere, where great estates existed, still kissed the hands of their superiors. They were beaten in the 1930s. That was not so long ago, historically. And in countries like in Poland, and in Hungary, and etc., etc., in the Baltic states, and even in some states in eastern Germany, humility and humiliation and deference to your social superiors and your deprivation of a common culture was, a matter of life for most people. That has disappeared. But this has nothing to do with socialism. It has been a great and momentous and important development within a world in which the basic givens of capitalism, the basic givens of property, the basic givens of automatically growing capitals in conflict with one another, and the concomitant problems of accumulation and conflict still obtain, as they obtained 300 years ago. So on the one hand, we had enormous advances. On the other hand, the task for people like ourselves only begins. Thank you.